Hi, everybody. It's a rainy Friday, and myself, Trevin McGee, am here with Eric Moline and Trey Hawk, all from scenestealers.com.
How's it going, eh?
Hello.
Hey there, fellas. And we are here today to talk about movies, specifically Chronicle, The Woman in Black, and last but not least, this tiny little movie that no one's heard of called The Artist.
Yeah, and we haven't, for some reason, none of us have reviewed it on the site.
No.
Or talked about it or anything. And I think that was because, at least for me, I'm waiting for it to come to Topeka or Manhattan so I can cover it on Kansas First News. And it still isn't there.
No.
So we're just going to talk about it today.
It is in Liberty Hall.
There you go. Liberty
and
Hall
so
in Lawrence, Kansas.
That's our excuse.
And it's been in Kansas City since Christmas.
Yeah, for quite a bit. Yeah.
I did write a little blurb about it.
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you review it?
I didn't review it.
Oh, you put it on your top 10
of
the year.
It was low in the top 10, and that's about the way I feel about it.
All right, well, let's not give away too much, but now you know how Trey feels about The Artist.
Exactly, specifically.
All right, well, let's get back to Chronicle. Let's talk about Chronicle real quick. Eric and I both got to see Chronicle earlier. Trey didn't. We made him stay in the car. So it was just Eric and I and a bunch of other people, and we just kept texting Trey how much fun we were having.
So Chronicle is a movie. The screenplay was written by Max Landis, who is the son of John Landis.
That's
and
true.
This movie was on Hollywood's famed blacklist. The screenplay was for a long time.
Yep. And the blacklist, if you don't know, is just a big list of spec scripts that have a lot of heat behind them. And some great movies have been on the blacklist in the past. Zombieland is the last big one I can think of. But there have been quite a few notable movies. So much heat. Social Network was on the blacklist. I won't make a big, long, thing out of it, but there are a lot of great movies from the last several years have been blacklist scripts. So,
cool.
Continue.
Yeah, and so, and then they got, they hired this guy, Josh Trask, to direct it. I believe at one point, after coming on as the director, he must have pitched in on the script because he also had a screenplay credit, I noticed.
Yeah.
But the film follows three young boys who come upon this glowing thing underground. They explore a hole in the ground, and they don't really go into that, which is, I think, fine, because the movie isn't about the origin of where this came from. But this thing, just being near it and touching it, gives them telekinesis and the ability to move other objects. And as they soon discover, they are objects of themselves that can also be moved.
Yes.
And so it's essentially they get superpowers. And what we're dealing with is we've got three actors who previously unknown to me.
Pretty much.
Sure.
I mean, there's what I guess would be the lead character, Dane DeHaan. He was in a couple episodes of True Blood, and then he had a whole character arc on the second season in Treatment. Michael B. Jordan is Wallace from The Wire season one. And, he's also had some TV stuff. Yeah, and he was in Friday Night Lights seasons 4 and 5, and I think he might still be kicking around TV in different places.
So you're his biggest fan?
I'm a big fan. Michael B. Jordan fan. Yeah, you took a really roundabout way of explaining that movie. It's a found footage.
I was getting there.
Well, that's the big
thing. I was
going to
say, that's the thing that makes it different from all the other superhero movies, because essentially we're seeing an origin story. But the conceit is that the main character, I love when they do this. This was such a dumb thing at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
He says, hey, I just got this camera, so I'm going to be filming everything from here on out.
Yeah.
Like, it could have just been, I don't think that line needed to be there. It could have just been in his character to be the kind of guy that films things. He didn't need to say, I just got this, and everything that you see from here on out, I'm going to be filming.
Yeah.
But they cheat a couple times, and there are other characters with cameras, and then things like security cameras and things like that.
Yeah,
so
they never really explain how it all gets spliced together,
and
because they're and that's fine, but that's sort of you call it a cheat, but that is the way they get around having to keep it all from a single perspective. Is it all comes from, and supposedly none of it's from an omniscient camera,
right?
There's a source for every shot. And that actually, I thought, works out really well during the explosive finale, the way that they cut all that together. I won't spoil any of it, but there's some really inventive ways that they track this action that kind of goes all the way across Seattle.
Yeah.
And is in the sky and on the ground, and they have some pretty inventive ways to do that.
All I can say is thank God that they didn't do the Paranormal Activity thing and just limit it to you know, them only filming things when they're trying to catch ghosts or what. I mean, the limited idea behind that or the idea of that is so limiting that you can't even get time for character development or any sort of compelling story because of that limitation. And in Cloverfield, they did a good job of going around that.
Yeah.
And I think in this movie, they do an even better job.
I think so. And the reason I think they do is because there are a lot of moments. It's a very efficient movie. I mean, it's about 90 minutes almost exactly. And that doesn't leave a lot of room for extra character details. There were some characters that I thought were kind of wobbly, particularly Alex Russell's the actor's name. I can't remember his character's name, but he's the third guy that gets powers. He's not very well developed. But overall, it's you know, the thing that makes it work is that it's also a pretty effective teen drama. There's, you know, because there are all those scenes of sort of being outcast or ostracized, and they take a lot of themes about, you know, like adolescence and growing up, and then they apply this sort of superhero rhetoric to it.
There's a little Let the Right One In this movie.
There's a little Let the Right One In. There's also, I mean, it's a cliche and comic book lore at this point, but you know how, you know, Uncle Ben always said, with great power comes great responsibility, and they really explore that a lot. Like, you get to see these kids get sort of a new, unfathomable power, and they play with it. And that some of those the scenes are the best parts of the movie.
They make the critical decision not to tell anybody that they have these powers. They keep it secret between the three of them, and each of them has a slightly different idea of what they should be used for and a slightly different upbringing and background that will cause them to react in different ways. And that's really what drives the whole movie.
Yeah, and so it's really cool that they spent time, you know, seeing this friendship develop over this shared commonality that they all have, this newfound commonality.
Yeah.
That's really affecting and really well done.
The whole first half of the movie is just an escapist.
Just fun escapism.
Roller coaster ride. It's I think the poster that I saw the other day said something like "Boys will be boys."
Yeah.
That was the tagline of the poster.
I saw a poster with the
It sells it short, but that's perfect for the first half of this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, they have a lot of fun with these superpowers, and the scenes are pulled off in a very realistic manner with the CGI because of this camera. You are really into this idea that what if I had these and how much fun would that be? And
or I would have you know, it sounds dumb, but I kept thinking, yeah, I probably would have done that.
Yeah.
Like, if I had powers, I probably would have.
It's a pretty smart movie,
that.
All things
considered.
It's very clever.
My biggest complaint, I liked that. I won't, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything because I think it merits being seen and not being spoiled, but you know, every story needs a villain. Every creation story needs a villain. Every origin story needs a villain, you know? And I didn't like how they kind of sped through the development of that. They kind of hinted at it for a while, and then about three convenient things happen, bam, bam, bam. And then
really
you've
terrible
got
things
really
all in
terrible,
a row and,
to be
and,
fair,
and
really
somewhat,
terrible things.
But somewhat contrived.
Yeah. And then suddenly you've got this Akira-level villain. That's the other thing. The finale made me think of Akira a lot, just because it's telekinesis and, you know, like, things are exploding. And, you know, it made me kind of think of Akira, and I thought that was awesome. And I hope that's as close to a live-action Akira as we ever get.
I read that the budget for this movie was $15 million.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a kind of movie that was shot on these cameras, but the special effects, there's a lot of them in here. And I thought that for the most part, some of the flying scenes, not so much, but for the most part, I think that they were very realistic.
Yeah, that first flying scene, it's blatantly obvious that Michael B. Jordan is just on wires. Like, he does one of those pirouettes in the air that you can only do when you've got wires attached to your waist.
Yeah. But you know what? That's the thing. Is the movie, if the movie wasn't good, then we would bitch about that and that would be a big deal. But the movie draws you in. Yeah. It is character-based. And for the most part, it succeeds.
Yeah.
And so you don't notice that stuff.
And it's got a great viral campaign and good word of mouth. Everyone that came out of it was like, I heard people talking about how good it was. And it was a very, you know, broad test crowd. I was surprised. So
you don't like women then or what?
Yeah, I can't. Yeah. I just don't know how to talk to them.
You guys are making me sad. I sat in the car.
So anyway, we should wrap it up. But I wrote the review for Chronicle this week, and I definitely gave it a solid rock fist. I thought it was a surprisingly good example of the found footage genre.
Absolutely. Solid Rock Fist for me, too.
Good.
Did you put "When great with great power comes great responsibility" in your review?
I hope that I steered clear of it. But
I hope you did, too, because I put it in mine.
Yeah.
That I shot last night.
Yeah. But to be fair, I wrote mine in the morning. So
okay.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So let's move on. Let's talk about
The
Woman in Black. Yeah, Trey, you've been so patient.
I know.
And I'm going to just interrupt you the whole time now like an asshole.
I don't know that I'm that excited about talking about this movie.
Oh, it's one of those.
Yeah. all right. The Woman in Black is a ghost story, haunted house story that has Mr. Daniel Radcliffe in it playing Arthur Kipps. He's
from Equus?
Yes.
Oh,
exactly.
Man.
He's a theater performer. Anyway, he's playing Arthur Kipps, who's a young lawyer who has, within the last couple of years, lost his wife at childbirth, is attempting to kind of get over that and going through a troubled mourning period.
How old is he?
He's a young father. They never establish. They never say, "Oh, hey, 23-year-old."
Do you think of him as a boy, or does he pull off being a father?
I don't find him as a father very compelling. Okay. There's a lot about this film that I don't find terribly compelling.
I wish there was a scene where he said, "You know, how could I have lost my wife and child at the tender age of 22?"
Right? Yeah. Exactly. But he's, you know, he's a young father, turn of the century, London lawyer, and he's struggling to kind of, you know, get beyond the death of his wife and kind of reclaim his wife or reclaim his life, not his wife. So the law firm that he works for sends him on this little journey to this village. An elderly woman has died, and her estate has been turned over, and he has to go through all of the paperwork. He arrives at the village, and we find out that this house is haunted by this malevolent spirit, the Woman in Black. And every time you see her, some tragic event befalls one of the children in the village. So over the course of the recent past and, you know, the sort of the history of this village and when Daniel Radcliffe, you know, when Arthur Kipps shows up, we basically see the demise of a number of children. So I guess if you don't like children, you're going to love The Woman in Black.
I saw something online that I wanted to ask you about because we talked about this briefly, but somebody said, on Twitter, a film critic, "I don't understand why everybody is so pissed off about all the jump scares in The Woman in Black because the movie itself, beyond that, was really good." Can you react to that statement?
I can absolutely react to that. This is one of the things that I'm irritated about with this film, is that a good ghost story, to me, is always a mystery. A ghost is a troubled spirit that is, you know, sticks around for some reason. So there's always this mystery. And, you know, films like Poltergeist or The Others or, you know, I mean, any number of films like that will explore that mystery. And the mystery is good enough to keep us compelled, even when we're not getting those, like, pop-up scares or those little, you know, I call them cheap thrills, because there's nothing that's staying or telling about, like, as far as the story, about somebody just jumping out and scaring us. And this film solves the mystery about halfway through, which is way too early. And the other thing is the mystery itself isn't that interesting or compelling. So then it just becomes basically this bizarre kind of horror action film where literally Arthur is trying to fight or best this ghost. So it relies entirely on this these little jump scares or these pop-up scares. And which, you know, there some of the crowd was laughing and giggling. So, I mean, people obviously get some sort of, you know, little adrenaline rush and enjoyment out of them.
Yeah.
I find them really uncompelling. They tend to make me anxious in a way that, you know, is just gets at the nature of who I am.
But especially when they're not earned.
Right. When they're not earned, it really, you know, they really irritate me. So they solve the mystery really quickly. Then it could have become maybe a slightly interesting character drama, so about this central character. But to me, it fails again because Daniel Radcliffe really just does not have the chops to sustain that. I found him.
Harry Potter fans everywhere are weeping.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is that I found him uncompelling, uninteresting.
Do you think this movie is going to help him put any distance between himself and that?
And a career? No. It is a different role. He is exceptionally dour without being sort of an anxious teenager. So, yeah, maybe it might distance him from the Harry Potter franchise a little bit. And I do think, you know, lovers, somebody who's just looking for a horror-ish themed roller coaster ride may go to it and find some sort of distraction from it.
I love horror-ish themed
horror-ish.
Horror-ish. Yeah, no, a horror themed, you know, just kind
yeah,
of
yeah. Yeah.
fun distraction.
Sure.
They may find some enjoyment out of this film, but it is to me utterly forgettable. Mm-hmm. And Karen Hines and Janet McTeer are part of the supporting cast. Mm-hmm. And they both are good. You know, they bring the consistent sort of, you know, gravitas and weight to their roles, but they aren't in it. It's really just about this one central character, so they aren't in it enough to, you know, bring us, to draw us in. I think one of the things that I said is that if the camera, in my review of it, was that if the camera weren't pointed squarely at Daniel Radcliffe the entire film, we would forget that he was there. He's just not very interesting.
All right.
Is this movie rated PG-13?
I'm not sure.
I think it was.
It can't be R if they're going to have Radcliffe in a movie.
I don't think so.
Not exceptionally violent.
No, not exceptionally violent. Okay. Yeah.
What was the last horror movie you saw that you liked?
I'm not a huge horror fan. Uh-huh. In fact, I don't like horror at all. To be honest,
we'll do about $1.30 there.
What?
You're not a huge
fan. Yeah. I'm a $1.30 horror fan.
You have one more. You have one more of those. One more bad joke, and then you have to go. Sit in the corner.
Infection has invaded my brain as well.
I'm not even sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's your rating, sir?
Mine are Rock Fist Down.
Okay. Fair enough. Wow.
And now to you, Malene.
Is it me?
It's you.
Okay. So the artist is a French movie.
Yeah.
Shot in Hollywood. Yeah. Directed by Michel Hazanavicius.
Yeah, Michel Hazanavicius.
Who has already won the Directors Guild Award. The movie has already run the Producers Guild Award, and it's won every other freaking award. So it is the Slumdog Millionaire of 2012.
Yep.
It's a silent film, which makes people who are coming away from it feel like they've just seen something incredibly artistic and daring.
Yeah.
And in one respect, it is daring because that format hasn't been used since the 30s.
Right.
So good for them, and it's a very charming film. On the other hand, it's about as formulaic a rise and fall slash romantic comedy film can get.
Yeah.
And so I'm very, very, let's just put it this way. I know I am safe in recommending this to any single person. I don't think there's anybody out there that can go to this movie and not come away from it feeling like they've just seen a fine piece of entertainment. It's very charming. I think that Jean Dujardin in the lead role is perfectly cast as this silent film star who
sort of an Errol Flynn type.
Yeah. But he can't seem to make the transition. We find out later why that is to sound. I think Berenice Bejo is a very charming and peppy, no pun intended, co-star. She should probably be in the Best Actress category, though, and not supporting actress. But,
right.
Weinstein very skillfully steered her in that category where she had better chances earlier in the season.
They're very good at doing that.
But The Artist is a silent movie for people who don't think that they can watch a silent movie, because there really is no way that anybody could come out of this film and not be at least mostly entertained.
Yeah.
I think it suffers from some third act problems because the story is pretty rote in that way. And there's a clever scene early on with an interesting use of sound that I thought maybe hinted at some deeper things in the film. And then it just kind of abandoned that a little bit.
Yeah,
so that was a sad as me, for me as well. This movie didn't make my top 10.
Yeah, I think it's. I honestly think it's the most overrated movie of the year.
It would be a tough candidate.
And I truly think that the only reason people are talking about it is because of its gimmick. I think that if it weren't,
well, no, it's not just the gimmick. It's because they use the gimmick, and it's an entertaining, crowd pleasing movie.
I mean, it
works.
Yeah.
If it didn't work, then people wouldn't be talking about it. But
no, that's not true. People talk about stuff that doesn't work all the time.
Yeah.
Bad 3D.
Descendants,
great example.
Help. Both give The Artist a run for its money as far as the
overrated. Oh yeah, for sure.
2011.
But
for sure.
The Help is an audience favorite, but not critically a favorite. And The Artist won the New York Film Critics Circle and the Critics' Choice Awards.
And
so
see,
I would say The Artist is more overrated.
This really just illustrates something that I don't like in criticism a lot. It's when you have people that are sort of writing from a very, you know, film student background. I think it's a huge, huge boon for, you know, like people that are super, super familiar with the history and the sort of, you know, context that movies come
though,
from.
Out there.
Don't we all three have film script?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, absolutely.
But a lot of the critics out there also come from journalism background.
For sure.
And not, you know, I think some of the difficulty with some of the contemporary film criticism out there is that it's a journalism background, and it's not a film background.
Yeah.
But this film is undeniably, and I think it was built with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. It wasn't built to win Academy Awards.
No, yeah. I think it was just sort of a subtle little love note to that whole thing.
As far as its construction, it is a perfect critical darling.
Oh, yeah.
It is, you know, it is a silent film that is contemporary in feel.
Yeah.
That gives us all of the ability to talk about, you know, it takes place in a transitional time in film's history.
It's about
history.
Film, yeah.
Yeah,
it's about film, and that's always
it's
a big winner.
It's about the transition from silence to silent films to talkies. So
there are a ton of shots that are nods.
All of this stuff that we can talk about, you know, film history, change in film, the way we consume film today. I mean,
and to go with that, there's a ton of nods to other films. I mean, just shot compositions and things like that.
Sure.
And then even the soundtrack borrows music from other, you know, films from the era.
Absolutely. And here's my struggle with it. I did put it on my top 10.
Yeah.
It was low in the top 10, and it had absolutely no chance of making it higher than it did. But I and I think to some extent Eric have both been advocates for going back and watching old silent films.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of merit in doing that. And my hope, I don't know that this is ever going to be really borne out, but my hope is that this can be something of a gateway to that.
Yeah.
People exploring older silent films and getting to them. It definitely is a gesture towards that.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I struggle with about this is that it really is, it is formulaic, it is approachable. Mm-hmm. We understand basically what's going to happen from the get-go, but it's very well executed.
Yeah.
It's the same feeling that I have with like Shawshank Redemption, which I don't think should be one of the highest rated films on IMDb and whatnot. But it really just comes down to, it's like, it's not a game changer. It's not terribly unique, but
it's a story well told.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's one of those that, you know, I kind of go back and forth with, but I'm pretty happy that it's low in my top 10.
Yeah. I don't think you're wrong in putting it there. I you know, for me, my big hang up was just that I knew what was going to happen within the first 15 minutes. I knew how the whole movie was going to play out, and it didn't surprise me, which, you know, whatever. But it just left me bored. And so since I knew what was going to happen story-wise, I had to focus on everything else. I had to focus on the construction and the visual execution of the entire thing. I'm sorry?
Have you seen it twice?
Yeah.
I have, too. It doesn't play as well the second
time.
No, it doesn't.
But, you know, like I had to focus on those elements because the story I was prepared for, and this was the first time I saw it. And so I was kind of tired of the format by the end. I love how it wraps up and sort of what it segues into the next era it kind of winks at. I like that a lot. But overall, I was just kind of like, you know, that's it. It's over. And real quick before Eric jumps in, do you guys know if Turner still does Silent Sundays, Turner Classic Movies? Yeah. So that's a great, if you like the artist and you do want to get into more silent film, but you don't know where to get them from or a library or whatever, a great gateway into that is Turner Classic Movies. And I think if you have more than just basic cable, you get it. Mm-hmm. And also Oscar Month is also a great, Oscar Month is like the best time to have Turner Classic Movies because they just show Oscar winners all month long. So there's a double whammy for you. If you want to get into silent film or if you want to catch up on old Oscar winners, Turner Classic Movies is the best place to do that.
The last thing I want to say about the artist is something that Trey just reminded me of when he said it would be a really good gateway. For me, the reason it's an okay gateway, but not nearly as good of a gateway as Hugo, another movie that came out this year that dealt with silent film, is because the artist celebrates a kind of silent film that everybody knows exists. I think when people who don't know anything about silent film think of silent film, they think of Charlie Chaplin, they think of Harold Lloyd, they think of Buster Keaton, and they think, oh, those silent film comedies, they were charming and they had heart or whatever, and they had the fun slapstick and dancing and physicality or whatever. But Hugo celebrates Georges Méliès, which is an era of silent film that people don't even know existed. And yeah, a whole tradition came out of that was very visually oriented, very impressionistic. And I think a lot of people think that silent films are these charming little comedies. And so the artist doesn't really do much to further people's appreciation of the other kinds of silent films that there are out there. Certainly Fritz Lang and some of the other German expressionistic directors were way ahead of where we are even today sometimes from a visual standpoint. So for me, I would wholeheartedly recommend that people see Hugo, even though it doesn't quite have the buzz of the artist. I also think it's a way better movie.
I don't think anyone's going to argue. No one's going
to
argue
just
that.
I'm trying to think. I personally had seen Méliès before I ever sat through a full Chaplin film. So, I mean, but I think either way, the argument for silent films, the argument for older films, yeah, at a time when Hollywood really could make some stunning art,
it certainly makes it approachable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
People, yeah. And one of the strongest things that it does is it sort of, I don't want to say, you know, something like it captures a bygone era, because that's not really true. But it definitely at its best feels like a lot of old Hollywood movies felt, where you could tell that they were big productions, but you didn't care because you kind of marveled at the fact that it was a big production. And there are times in the movie where I kind of, that was an emotion that actually struck really well with me, was just feeling like, wow, this is a big, you know, it's an overgrown play, basically, and it's kind of neat to think of all the work that went into making that happen. And that was actually my favorite thing that came out of it.
So. And besides all the tribute and references and things, I think it still is actually kind of a very modern movie. There's still a lot of I don't think he's limited, that the director limited himself to, the constraints of silent cinema back then. So there's that. In addition to that, he's kind of pushing it forward. But after even all the negative things I've said about it, I'm still giving it a solid rock fist up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a like you said, it's a story well told. The production's outstanding, and I mean, I'd give it a solid as well.
I'm there too.
You know, like a 6 or 7 7 or 8 out of 10.
Seriously,
like
go see Hugo, people. What's going on? Sorry.
End of, right. End of really, just go, go see Singing in the Rain or Sunset Boulevard.
No, there you go.
Yeah, that's very true. All right, well, that's the last movie. As we said, that opens in Lawrence. It's in Lawrence right now. It's been in Kansas City for quite some time. If you haven't seen it, it's still playing, and you should definitely check it out. This is the part where we promote our Oscar party again.
Yes.
We still can't tell you where it's at.
No. Regrettably. It's proving
really
to be
hard to promote something where I am honor bound to not say where it's at.
I will say this.
There is a secret handshake, and we will put a video up.
It's in Midtown Kansas City, mm-hmm. and it might be in the Martini District.
Ooh.
How's that?
That's good.
I'm counting on the fact that the guys who own the bar will never get this far into the podcast.
Well.
So, yeah, the KC Oscar Party, Lost in Reviews, Scene Stealers coming together. We have a ballot up on the website. I'll probably need to feature it again on the front a little bit more, but you can fill that ballot out and pick the winners, and we will have it printed off for you when you come to the party, or you can bring one with you to the party as long as it's
just fill
in.
It out there.
Yeah, turned in before 7:30 mm-hmm. When the Oscars start, and the winner's going to get a ton of money, and we're going to have tons of prizes and giveaways and free movie posters.
When he says tons of money, he means literally dozens of dollars.
No, last year it was like over $100.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Dozens of dollars.
Bouquets of dollars.
Yeah, bouquets of bucks. It's definitely worth checking out. You should come. We've had potlucks in the past. We've done all kinds of stuff. It's going to be a really great time. And we'll all be hosting and joking around and doing dumb stuff while we're there. So, yeah, you should all come and enjoy yourselves. So, on behalf of Eric Moline, who had to run, Trey and I are going to take off. So, have a good weekend, everybody.
Adios.
And we'll see you next week.